From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, after the July flood, how well did FEMA perform? How the search for flood victims continues along the Guadalupe River, and pregnant and in jail proves to be deadly for women and their babies.
Support for this podcast of Texas Matters comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company by investing in local communities and rewarding policyholders for prioritizing safety. They are building a more resilient Texas. More at texasmutual.com/texansgetit. Texas Mutual. Texans get it.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Days after the July 4th flash flood that hit the Upper Guadalupe River, President Trump arrived in Kerr County and praised the response efforts of FEMA.
FEMA has deployed multiple emergency response units, and FEMA has been really headed by some very good people. We have some good people running FEMA. It's about time.
Trump went on to claim that this was the best disaster response in the history of FEMA. But now, months later, how well did FEMA actually do in Kerr County? I decided to take a look. At the Doyle Community Center in Kerrville, Texas Rio Grande Legal Aid is holding a free clinic for people who were impacted by the July flood but had their cases rejected by FEMA.
They need to be abolished.
Mike Richards came to the clinic because he lost so much during the flood.
Man, I lost a house. I lost welding trailers. I lost boat trailers, and they won't give me a penny, you know.
Richards isn't alone. He says many of his friends aren't getting FEMA help either. Data shows that only about 20% of applicants for federal disaster assistance from Kerr County have been deemed eligible to get financial help. That's according to the nonprofit policy and advocacy group Texas Appleseed.
What we're seeing is something really unusual.
That's Maddie Sloan, Texas Appleseed's director of the Disaster Recovery and Fair Housing Project. She's been tracking FEMA approvals from the July flood, and she says many applications aren't being referred for recovery assistance. She says over half of FEMA applications are not even evaluated to figure out whether people were eligible for assistance.
Sort of disappears into a black box. But what it means is that the family never gets a decision saying you're eligible, you're ineligible, we need different information. You submit the application and you never hear anything else.
The July 4th flood was a disaster that claimed at least 117 fatalities in Kerr County alone. The Guadalupe River rose extremely quickly and surged above 35 feet. As for the impact on property, in Kerr County, more than 2,000 structures were damaged or destroyed.
So we see a lot of FEMA denials.
Brittany Gomez is the disaster benefits team manager at Texas Rio Grande Legal Aid. She says there are lots of reasons why disaster survivors are having trouble dealing with the bureaucracy of FEMA.
It could be a disaster survivor just needs to provide FEMA updated contact information, or it can be a more serious legal issue where they don't have clear title to their home, or maybe they bought their RV or manufactured home from a friend and title was never formally transferred. Those are all things that we can help them with.
But Sloan at Texas Appleseed says the FEMA problems with the July flood go beyond the typical red tape that happens in every natural disaster. She says the high rate of rejections in Kerr County are very unusual.
After Hurricane Beryl, well over 80% of applications were referred for individual. The numbers in Kerr County are dramatically different. Less than half of applications were referred for individual assistance in Kerr County.
Sloan says this is just one of the multiple FEMA disappointments in the July flood, including the lack of response at the FEMA call center in the days after the disaster.
Between July 6th and July 10th, FEMA only answered about 15,000 of the 55,000 calls that came in. And we don't know how many of those Texans, never called back.
It wasn't until July 10th that the then acting FEMA head, David Richardson, sent a memo to DHS Secretary Kristi Noem requesting approval for call center vendors. Also, FEMA did not send out a disaster survivor assistance team to Kerr County.
So FEMA terminated that entire program in May. They are not going to send survivor assistance teams door to door in the future. What FEMA said was that it was wasteful and ineffective.
FEMA's performance in Kerr County did not go unnoticed. In late July, Richardson was questioned about it in a congressional hearing. Members of Congress from both parties sharply criticized the agency and him directly.
It was reported that during the flood crisis, Richardson was unreachable for nearly 24 hours, which delayed the deployment of search and rescue assets. Representative Greg Stanton was particularly pointed.
Where were you on July 4th and July 5th of this year?
On July 4th, I was on vacation.
When did you return from your vacation?
I returned the next day.
So on July 5th, you returned to Washington, D.C.?
I spent the entire vacation in my vehicle speaking on my phone to either the state of Texas or DHS coordinating for the events in Texas.
Were you on the first plane back to Washington then from your vacation?
I was in my truck.
This wasn't just incompetence. It wasn't just indifference. It was both. And that deadly combination likely cost lives.
Richardson described the agency's response to the flood as a model for how disasters should be handled. Weeks after the deadly July 4th floods, Ken Packrick, the head of FEMA's Urban Search and Rescue Branch, resigned, citing frustrations with delays that slowed the agency's response. And this week, Richardson resigned from FEMA. His departure followed widespread criticism of his performance with the July flood and general lack of experience in emergency management.
In the Kerr County flood, at least 117 people lost their lives, and two people are still missing. The search for their remains continues now 4 months later. Texas Monthly writer Peter Holly spent time with the Texas Rangers as they hunt for the remaining victims.
I think people didn't realize that after the first few weeks of searching, that the search continued largely outside of public view, and it's extremely active. Every day, members of the Texas Rangers are along the Guadalupe River looking for the remains of two people who remain missing, Seal Stewart and Jeff Ramsey. Seal Stewart is the last little girl who went missing from Camp Mystic, and the Rangers are continuing to search relentlessly and pouring lots of resources into that effort.
Cecilia Stewart, 8 years old, so she would have been, you know, a small person. A person of that size probably would be swept away way downstream. So they have found remains from Camp Mystic 30 miles downstream, haven't they?
Yeah, you know, the longest person who disappeared on the river traveled 53 miles. The longest Mystic camper traveled about 20 miles. And of course, when you're talking about Mystic campers, unfortunately, we are talking about children. And we're talking about sometimes bodies that have been dismembered and decomposed. So you're not necessarily looking for a body. You're unfortunately looking for pieces of a body at this point.
The Texas Rangers, they have devoted an amazing amount of resources working on this, trying to find those remains. Talk about what types of resources they're using, including a lot of cutting-edge science.
Yeah, it's really incredible. When you're out there, you realize that this is an incredibly dedicated team, and it's still large. Early on, you know, they were hundreds of people out there, even thousands in the broader search. Now it's a bit smaller, but they are relying on some really high-tech resources. I can run through a few if that's helpful.
Yeah.
So the Rangers are relying on technology like sonar, which does underwater mapping using sound waves. They're using LIDAR, which you've probably seen on self-driving cars. This is often used in military applications as well. And oftentimes, archaeologists are using LIDAR to map the rainforest in Central America to find ruins. And they're using this same technology to map the Guadalupe River to find places where anomalies exist, or where vegetation has disappeared, or where they think that a body might still be.
Rapid DNA analysis, machine learning tools, looking at the new redefined, terraformed landscape. A lot going on there, and still using cadaver dogs. It seems like every tool they have available, they're deploying here.
Yeah, and these aren't just ordinary cadaver dogs. These are an even more rare cadaver dog that it's able to detect human scent beneath the water. And so they're actually, this is an experimental effort. The man leading the effort, a man named Captain John Miller, he is in close touch with Texas State University and with Special Forces soldiers. He has a military background. And so there's a lot of consultation going on with experts outside of Texas to figure out what the best tools are and what the best ways to map this area so that the search can continue effectively.
Captain Miller is a Kerrville native. Does he feel a strong connection, personal connection to what happened here?
Yeah, you know, I was really struck when I began reporting on this story. I thought I might kind of encounter hyper-professional law enforcement types who didn't really wear their heart on their sleeve. But the more you talk to these guys, people like Captain Miller, the more you realize that they are deeply emotionally invested in this this search effort. And Mr. Miller himself grew up in Kerrville and now has returned to his home, to the river that he swam in as a child. And so this is a deeply personal effort for him.
They have photos of Stuart that are featured prominently. They really have made an emotional connection with this mission. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. When I was in their headquarters outside of downtown Kerrville, SEAL Stuart's photo is everywhere. You see it like when you walk in the building, and then even on their computers, people who have little images of SEAL, just as this constant reminder of the stakes here. They've closely talked with the family and other families. They know these individuals without meeting them. And that very much comes across. I felt a huge amount of kind of emotional connection between the searchers and the victims.
And you also write about how the Rangers are really pushing themselves in this search. They're working around the clock. They have constant working on the phones, trying to get updates from the field. This is something that they really are dedicating themselves to far beyond a job.
I think that's totally right. I think that for many of them, this is a new experience. You know, Rangers are often involved in cold cases and in criminal investigations. They have never at this scale been involved in a natural disaster. And so part of that required them to get close to the victims and their families. And so I find that they're just deeply invested. I was really taken aback by how moving their connection to the victims was or is.
So all of this work that they're doing, mapping out what happened with the flood, where the water did the most damage, you know, how the dams worked and didn't work at some places. Is that information that's also being transferred into trying to figure out how to avoid this in the future?
Yeah, one of the most important things I learned in this reporting effort was that the Texas Rangers are on an unprecedented quest to recreate digitally what happened on July 4th. The point of that is to create a digital model that can be accessed by policymakers, law enforcement, and family members, and anyone else who wants to understand how this flood happened. The larger goal, the long-term goal, is to figure out why it happened and how it can be prevented in the future.
And you reported that searchers found remains as high as 50 feet above the normal water line. What does that tell us about the dramatic impact that that rainfall and the flood, the flash flood, had?
Not just 50 feet above the waterline, but sometimes 500 feet beyond where the typical waterline is. And in certain places, the water went from 50 gallons a second to 1.6 million. So what that tells us is that this is an unprecedented flood. Not that it can't happen again as climate changes, but the amount of water that was funneled into the Guadalupe that morning, we don't think that's ever happened in the past. It's appears unprecedented.
Well, how much longer are they going to be doing this?
We don't really know. They say they will keep going until they're told to stop. And so they've been going for 4 months. I think in their minds, they have no desire to stop, and they will keep pushing. I think that's up to the state government, though.
Peter Holley is a writer with Texas Monthly. His story takes us inside the Texas Rangers' relentless high-tech search for the last Mystic camper. Pregnant women, frequently locked up for petty, nonviolent crimes, can find themselves crying for medical help, but their pleas are ignored. The result can lead to long-lasting medical issues or death. A year-long investigation from Bloomberg Law and NBC News reveals systemic civil rights failures for pregnant women in jail. Mackenzie Mays is with Bloomberg Law.
We found more than 50 civil rights lawsuits have been filed across the country by women who allege that they were so severely mistreated while pregnant and in jail that it led to miscarriages, stillborns, their babies being born in jail and then later dying. And we also found two cases where women themselves died while pregnant.
The article centers on the case of Chastity Congeas. She was a 21-year-old Texas woman. She was experiencing a mental health crisis when her mother called 911 seeking help. And so she wasn't really in jail for committing a crime, but she was incarcerated. And she went into labor, had no medical support. Her baby, Zenora, was born with the umbilical cord around her neck and died 10 days later. Why focus on Chastity's story?
So we met with Chastity. She, like all of the women in our story, was in jail, not prison. So all of the women that we found were being held pre-trial while pregnant. And in her case, her charge was dismissed, which really had her family, you know, obviously they were grieving the loss of what would have been the first grandchild. But I think the fact that the charge was dismissed and that she did not need to be jailed at all in the eyes of her family really added sort of a layer of anger there. They had called 911 to get help because she does have schizophrenia and other disabilities, and she needed help medically and instead was arrested. So we met with Chastity and her family in Fort Worth, and it was very clear that what the jail described, like being childlike, they, you know, they said that she might not even know what a contraction was. That's how much help she needed. But she was alone in jail when the labor pains came. And Zenora was born into her pant leg and was found sort of still in her uniform. And she was nearly catatonic. She was bleeding out and she never got to hold her. And she was not allowed to go to the funeral. And then she was released from jail shortly after her daughter died.
The investigation, you document cases of women giving birth alone on jail floors and toilets while officers ignored their pleas for help. Some mothers chewed their own umbilical cords to save the newborns. Others were delivered stillborn after hours of unanswered cries for medical care. How big of a problem is this? Because it seems like looking at these cases, these federal civil rights cases, it's probably just a fraction of the true scale of the incidents that just don't get reported.
Yeah, you're definitely right. So we found 54 lawsuits filed since 2017, and every expert we talked to said this is for sure an undercount. The only reason we know about these cases is because people sued, and we know that it can be hard to sue. It can be a lot of work or time or money. And so we know that it's a problem across the country. A lot of what happens in jails depends on the resources and the funding that they have to provide medical care, whether somebody is on staff around the clock, which is what you would need for a pregnant detainee, or whether it's a lot of jails hire for-profit companies to sort of handle that medical care separately. And we spoke to more than 60 people trying to figure this out. And there were calls on sort of both sides of the issue saying one solution is to not jail pregnant people pre-trial at all.
Well, Texas officially considers itself a pro-life state. And that protecting the lives of the unborn and of newborn is supposed to be a state priority. Do you find these policies, lack of policies, lack of oversight, no tracking of pregnancies, outcomes in jails, is that in contradiction to the idea that Texas is a pro-life state?
I can tell you that that question has been asked since the story has published, including from experts in Texas who make your exact point. I believe we have 7 cases in our database in Texas, but at the same time, Texas confirmed for us that they do not count a stillborn baby as a death in custody because technically the baby's not in custody. So while there are laws about reporting a death in jails in Texas, that doesn't count if you're a baby. And I think that has drawn people to sort of draw that juxtaposition and wonder why that doesn't count in jails, but is seemingly important in other instances.
So you're talking about jails. That's basically the county lockup.
Yes.
And they're required to provide medical care. So why aren't they getting the medical care that they need?
Yeah, the law is there. It's a constitutional right to have medical care while you're incarcerated. And it falls under cruel and unusual punishment if otherwise. But there's no specificity in the law that tells jails exactly what qualifies as that medical care. And as you know, local jails, everything is local control and everything changes from jail to jail. So whether or not, for example, you can afford to give a pregnant woman in jail around the clock care really depends on the jail itself. There's no federal law that says this is exactly how you must do it. And so people fall through the cracks.
The staff, the guards at the jail, it seems that they assume that the women are exaggerating symptoms, or they say they're unfit mothers, or they dismiss when the inmate, when they say, I'm having pain, I'm having contractions, I'm going through labor, and then they say, we don't believe you. Is that what happens?
We saw allegations of that again and again, and we know that women in any medical setting have reported being dismissed or ignored. And then the experts and the women themselves told us that when you're in jail, there's an added layer to that, right? Because they felt they were being judged for being pregnant, for being in jail, that they were unworthy mothers, that, you know, if you cared enough about your child, then you wouldn't be here. And that just wasn't true, because many of these women, every woman I talked to, cared a whole lot. And, you know, when they were forced to give birth in the cell by themselves, they did everything they could to try to save their baby. As you mentioned, we had a woman who chewed through her own umbilical cord. We have women who scooped, you know, the mucus out of their baby's mouths or tried to, you know, fetch them out of the toilet because that's where they were being born, and pounding on doors. And so, yes, they said they tried everything they could, and sometimes they succeeded and sometimes they failed.
So you mentioned that several Texas jails did not have adequate medical staff on duty when women went into labor. How widespread is that problem of inadequate staffing in this context?
It's hard to quantify, because sometimes even when you do have the right policy on the books, it isn't followed, right? So we've requested as many records requests as we could to look through what policies were on hand, what the staffing was like. And sometimes we did find sort of cost-cutting measures where we know that it is cheaper for a correctional officer, for instance, to drive a woman to the hospital instead of calling an ambulance. We have a case where a correctional officer stopped at Starbucks on the way to the hospital and a baby died in that case. So we know it's a problem, regardless of whether we're talking about pregnancy, that staffing in jails for medical care is an issue and has been.
Are there protocols and procedures and policies in place for when there is a woman who is pregnant and being incarcerated?
There are. They sort of run the gamut. We couldn't really find any uniform policy, and a lot of the experts we talked to said that's part of the problem, right? There should be some sort of rule, whether it's saying, hey, let's do house arrest instead and don't have this problem at all, or it's as soon, you know, at the first complaint to make sure that there's an ambulance and hospital care and OBGYN care. So yeah, it really just depends on the jail.
And when they have a policy, are they even following it?
Sometimes there will be a policy on the books and then it's not actually followed on the ground. We found that in some of our cases in the story. In Chastity's case, actually, Tarrant County Jail had a pregnancy protocol, and they denied some of her allegations. But obviously she did give birth in jail alone. So she wasn't, you know, monitored in that very second at the very least.
You're reporting you had the video of some of these women going into labor in the jail cell alone, and you can just witness it. There are cameras there. There must be, isn't that monitoring? Can't they see that as well?
Yeah, in the cases you're talking about, we were able to get body camera footage that the officers were wearing. And so one of the cases that you'll see is a woman who is naked and visibly very pregnant and visibly in labor and saying as much, saying, I need help. But the officers say, you know, they sort of seem to misunderstand what's going on with her and sort of close the door and come back later. And by the time they come back again, a newborn baby's there.
Many women say they were put in isolation rather than giving medical attention. How is putting someone in isolation supposed to be addressing the issue?
Yeah, that was a big theme in this story. They said, the women told us and said so in their lawsuits, that they were put in isolation because they were being punished, that they were complaining so much and saying, I really need to see a doctor. My abdomen really hurts. I'm in pain. I'm bleeding. And that because of that, they were put in an isolated cell away from the general population. But some of the jails told us that that was for their own good, that it was sort of medical isolation to make sure that they were safe or to get more monitoring.
So in these cases where, because of the lack of medical care, there is a stillbirth, the child dies, is there any kind of repercussion, any kind of follow-up?
We found that there were many settlements, you know, payouts from counties, including Tarrant County. That was the largest settlement in history there, I believe. But if you mean something such as criminal, we didn't find any of that. We did find in a California case where doctors lost their medical licenses. In that case, a woman died while pregnant. These are civil rights allegations in federal court. And outside of that, that's really all we found.
What reforms do health experts say are urgently needed in Texas jails or jails across the country in order to protect pregnant women?
The biggest reform we've heard is pretty simple, and it's stop jailing pregnant women pre-trial for nonviolent crimes. They think you could avoid it altogether. Even sheriffs themselves told us that. They said, hey, look, we're not the judges. We didn't do the sentencing. And we agree we are not equipped to help pregnant women. And so I think that is really what everybody seems to agree on. But it might be easier said than done, right? I don't know if that's something that could happen at a federal level. I think it may have to be community by community.
Well, there got to be alternatives to incarceration rather than in a jail cell. Couldn't they be taken to a hospital and held in confinement there?
There are some alternative programs so that people outside of just sort of like house arrest, there are programs that are looking out for mothers who may be charged with crimes and trying to sort of help them be in some sort of home or setting that gives them resources and makes sure that them and their babies are safe.
What do you hope that lawmakers, sheriffs, the public, especially here in Texas, take away from your investigation? What changes would prevent more tragedies like Zenora's death?
Yeah, the most important thing for us was to just make sure that we could get as many women's stories told as possible. That's part of why we built a whole database. So you are able to go in there and read all 54 cases sort of outside of the story. You can type in Texas. You can type in whatever state you're looking for, whatever jail you're looking for. And, you know, hopefully if we hear more about this, more people will tell similar stories and in their own communities. Because like I said, we only know this because of the lawsuits that the women themselves filed.
Mackenzie Mays is an investigative reporter for Bloomberg Law. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. Email us at texasmatters@tpr.org. You can find us wherever you get cool podcasts. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.